Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 5 clarifying lecture. Not too many announcements this week. Just make sure that you are working with your partner for your peer review. Some of you have turned in videos separately from the document, so make sure that your partner has access to those videos as well. So that's it. As far as the behaviors bio is concerned, everybody is in a group. Like I said, just make sure all your documents are shared. And one thing I saw when I was looking over people's drafts is that a lot of you were not using in-text citations. So a couple of things to remember when you're writing a paper. First, paraphrase everything in your own words. Try not to use quotes. Okay, the more that you paraphrase in your own words, the better. And I was just on the Writing Center's website. They have some great resources if you're not so hot with this type of writing. They also have some great resources for peer review, so I would go and check those out. The second part is that whenever you take something from another source, it must be cited. If you do not do an in-text citation, APA 7th edition style, properly, that can be considered plagiarism. So you can't just lift something from a text, plop it into your paper, put a parenthetical citation in there, and call it a day. You really do have to paraphrase, and then even after you paraphrase, you still need in-text citations. Anything that has a citation should be in the bibliography and vice versa, so that's very, very important. All right, let's talk a little bit about inner teaching. There were no questions this week, so this is the last part of my clarifying lecture. So most of you said that you should not try to do a task analysis from just reading something, and that is true. You do need to do something yourself, watch someone who's very competent at it do it, or have them review it. It's very easy to miss something in a task analysis. When I teach this course face-to-face, what I'll often do is have people task analyze something, and I do it exactly the way that they have told me to do it. I don't assume anything. And you'll see how much you actually miss, how much you actually assume about people when you do something like that. Little terminology thing. I see a lot of people trying to elicit operant behavior. You can't do that. Elicit goes to Pavlovian or respondent learning. Evoke or occasion would be operant learning. Okay, so anything with a reinforcer is evoked. And something to remember is that these are principles, and when you get to 622, that's going to be super important, that these are not teaching techniques that we use with kids with autism. They are principles that guide everybody's behavior that we can sometimes use to change certain behaviors in certain people. That's all it is. So chaining, for example, real-world example of chaining would be where it wasn't used as a procedure, I was working with a child who flopped to the ground. And as soon as they flopped to the ground, someone would bring out a toy to lure them into the room that they were going. So what's the chain that's learned there? What chain is reinforced? Walk out, flop to the ground, toy comes out, go into the room, terminal reinforcer is the toy. So chains are not just used to teach. They are also all around us, okay? And if you look at how your behaviorist biography is set up, that's a chain. You do one step first, reinforce that step, next step, reinforce that step, next step, reinforce that step, and so on and so forth. We've also broken everything down into a task analysis. So there are specific instructions for every single part of your behaviorist bio. So it's chained, it's task analyzed. That's what we're talking about here. Shaping is not a DRA, okay? There is differential reinforcement involved in shaping. You will, in 622, get to experience shaping lever presses by a rat, so that's kind of cool. But shaping is not, if I use X, I get Y. That's not how it works. So what you're doing, a lot of you used a language example, Let's say, and I'm going to use another example from higher education. So let's say that I have you turn in drafts and I have you refine the draft and then refine the draft and then refine the draft and then refine the draft until it's a really nice paper. That's a shaping procedure. Okay, so I'm reinforcing, you know, this level of competency, and then I'm doing this. When you're learning these terms and everything like that, that's a shaping procedure because we are going to refine your vocabulary over and over and over and over again until that vocabulary is set in stone. So think about that as kind of a shaping procedure. Fading. Fading, a lot of you said fading prompts. You can fade all kinds of stuff out, but fading prompts is usually the one that everybody goes to. Explanatory fictions. This is super extra important. This is not just an exercise in, you know, higher ed, you know, things that people do in higher ed. An explanatory fiction is where you take something that is not observable and measurable and you use it to explain behavior because it will always be circular reasoning. So if I say Jimmy melts down because they're overwhelmed, how do you know they're overwhelmed? They melt it down. Why do they melt down? Well, they're overwhelmed. And you can see I could go in that loop for a really, really long time. Yeah, you're using unsafe hands. Well, what does unsafe mean? Okay, we're not very specific there. A student knows or understands. You know, so they did an equivalence class. That means a student knows and understands it. How do you know that they know and understand it? Well, they did the equivalence class. You see those go in circles. So what we do is that we instead just describe what we see. And sometimes I'll say it's like when you ever read like a police report or something where you go with just the facts. That's what you should be doing when you're writing any type of plan or you're assessing behavior. Because anytime that you're going into a place where you can't observe, measure, and confirm it, you're making assumptions, you're making guesses instead of using data to be your guide. So it really is important that you work on avoiding those explanatory fictions. Stimulus control. Now, in 622, you'll start talking about something called instructional control, which does not mean what you think it means. Stimulus control is the relationship between two stimuli. So when stimulus A reliably evokes or elicits, because you cannot respond in an operant stimulus control, stimulus A reliably evokes B, the behavior, that's stimulus control. There's nothing about controlling. And in some of my health coach classes and things like that, they'll say, use stimulus control. Control the stimuli in your environment to get the behavior that you want. That's not how it works. We are, if you think about it, we don't really have much to do with it. We're just kind of agents in the whole thing. What's happening is that there's relationship between stimuli and responding. So yeah, you know what? I can set my alarm across the room so that I have to get up and turn it off, which may then start the chain of getting myself to the gym. Sure, that's totally fine. But did I control the stimuli in my environment to get what I wanted? Not exactly. Because there has to be that relationship. And in order to teach, in order to establish that SD response relationship, you got to have that third term. You got to have that reinforcer. So that behavior has to be reinforced. That's the part that is a little sketchy for a lot of people. Remember that when you do this, you've got to have things in your own words. The idea is that you're talking about this stuff and you're able to say it in your own words. Because the more you're able to say it in your own words, avoid explanatory fiction, stay precise, the more fluent you'll become. And one of the pieces of feedback that I get from students when they take the BACB exam is being fluent in the basics. If you're very fluent in the basics, the fancy stuff, the assessments, the teaching procedures, all that stuff will be fine. It's being fluent in the basics. And one of the basics, let's talk about equivalence classes. Now, equivalence classes are kind of hard. I did my dissertation on something called relational frames. You're going to learn more about relational frames later on in this term. But let's talk about the three parts of this equivalence class. So you've got your A stimulus. So let's say that is a picture of a dog. Okay? Let's say B stimulus is the spoken word dog. Okay? Reflexivity, which a lot of you got, and it was awesome, is where you see reliable matching picture dog to picture dog. They have to be identical, so they can't be pictures of a bunch of different dogs. They have to be identical for reflexivity to occur. Let's say I teach the relationship, give me the picture of the dog. Okay, that's B to A relationship. Okay, so if I say, give me the dog, you get, that's a B to A relationship, that's that direction. So if I pick this up and I go, what is it? And the learner says dog, that's an untrained relationship. Okay, so that is symmetry that I've just shown there. Now let's say I teach picture of the dog, give me dog, great. And then I also teach give me dog to the written word dog. Okay? So I've taught picture to spoken word, and I've taught spoken word to written word. If that learner then can match the picture of the dog to the written word dog, that's transitivity. I never taught it. I never taught that relationship. I didn't have to. Because in an equivalence class, if you have a true equivalence class, if you teach A equals B and B equals C, C equals A should emerge without training. That's what an equivalence class is. Another one that, you know, you keep using that word, I don't think it means what you think it means, is motivating operations. So motivating operations and quote-unquote what motivates somebody are two different things. So what motivates somebody, even though I see students of Skinner even using this, is an explanatory fiction because motivation is a construct. It's not really a thing. It's not something you can really measure. So that's an explanatory fiction. So we don't want to say, let's find out what motivates the person. No. And also, you can't reinforce people, you can only reinforce their behavior. So what a motivating operation is, and I like to think about it like a light bulb with a dimmer switch. So imagine the reinforcement contingency, that three-term contingency inside the filament of a light bulb. Okay? So, and my dog is right behind me. I don't know if she's in the video or not, but she's right behind me. Let's say you have a light bulb and you have that contingency within the light bulb, right? The motivating operation is the dimmer switch on the light bulb. So when the dimmer switch is way up, the reinforcer is super powerful, okay? More likely to evoke a response from the individual. When the dimmer switch is low, the reinforcer isn't as powerful. So a common one is, you know, if you've eaten a large dinner, then, you know, a cookie is not nearly as reinforcing as if you haven't eaten all day. Okay? Think about it like the dimmer switch. So motivating operations do not motivate. They're antecedents that alter how bright or dim that reinforcing contingency is. Okay, so rule govern behavior and instructions. So rules can come in a lot of different forms. Rules can come in verbal form, like don't touch the hot stove. Rules can come in the form of teaching what you'll hear as a higher order class, where let's say, I use this a lot in health coaching, where you learn the rule, you know, I am overweight, so overweight people don't wear X clothing. That's a rule that you've kind of learned over time. And even if you lose, you know, a lot of weight, a lot of people still wear the clothes that they wore when they were overweight. And by the way, weight is not a behavior. So they've learned a rule that I dress this way. That is a rule. Instructions are a little different. Instructions function as SDs. Okay, so if I say, take out your behaviorist biography template, that's an instruction. If you're reading on the paper, you know, write 3 to 5 paragraphs about this, citing your sources, that's an instruction. If there is a picture on a door with, you know, one gender here and another gender here, that's an instruction. Okay, those are instructions. Instructions are SDs that help narrow down the response. And prompts, what are prompts? Prompts are helper variables. They should never have stimulus control. If they do have stimulus control, then there's something wrong. They're helper variables that are used to draw attending to that SD. So when you prompt, what you're doing is that you're making that SD way more obvious. Okay? They should not have stimulus control over the behavior. If the prompt has stimulus control, then you're in that category of what we call prompt dependent. Okay? So make sure that your prompts are always helper variables that help the learner attend to the SD. And again, remember, you're not controlling the stimuli and stimulus control. Okay, that's a huge, huge, huge thing. It is the control of that stimulus over responding. Okay? So, all right, so that's it. Those are my kind of clarifying points for the week. Thank you very much for watching, and we'll see you next time.